Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome back to our fifth anniversary special. This is Questions from Our Listeners, the second of several releases celebrating 5 years since our launch in 2015. In this release, we will address questions sent by you, our listeners, to us in a recent poll we conducted. And these were challenging questions, so here we go.
Hi, this is Dimitris, coming to you from Kuldīga in Latvia.
Hi, this is Miranda, coming to you from Leamington Spa in the UK.
Hi, this is Michael, coming to you from Utrecht in the Netherlands.
Hello, this is Jared, coming to you from Sydney in Australia.
And this is Tom, coming from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States. What we did a few weeks ago is we put out a call over social media for questions that you, the listeners, wanted us to address as part of this program. We were wide open of any kind of a question that you wanted to ask, so long, of course, it was within the realm of what we cover in the podcast. And we really greatly appreciate it for the tremendous response we received. What we did was we narrowed it down because a lot of the questions carried very, very common themes. So we've got five questions that we as a team are going to address, debate, discuss, what have you, based on what you said you were interested in. And Jared, who has been our champion on the social media side, is going to have the honor of introducing these questions. So Jared, why don't you go ahead and launch the first one?
Thanks, Tom. And yes, thank you to everyone for sending in their questions. It's always great to engage with the community, and this was a good way of doing that. Our first question today is, I was thinking about the politics of publishing in peer review nowadays. What does a naive junior scholar need to know to get their work published? Down to the nitty-gritty. So, who wants to share their thoughts first?
Yeah, well, clearly not, we're not experts on any of this, right? So we can't, and we will not indeed speak to the politics of publishing peer-reviewed articles, because that is a deep, deep rabbit hole we do not, nor are we qualified to go down. There's plenty of resources that journals provide with respect to meet the editors or similar events at conferences that junior scholars can benefit from by actually going and talking to the individuals who run these outlets. And of course, getting involved as a reviewer is immensely helpful in this respect. But anyone who wants to jump in, please go ahead.
I'm going to be drawing from the other release that's going to be coming very soon, where we had a chance to talk with some experts, some other scholars about the podcast. And this very subject actually came up in a way, because one of the things you want to think about, I think, is, it's not about necessarily the politics, because, you could look at any particular field, and they have their own different ways of packaging knowledge and what they consider to be good, bad, or whatever. I look at this as more of what can one do to better posture oneself to be successful as a author? Podcasting, just sort of to talk about what we do. One of the things that I think has been valuable from getting either into podcasting or into public scholarship like the blogosphere or other things is how well it helps you practice and refine your message. What it is that you want to research, what it is that you want to publish, what ideas that you have, and refine them in such a way that, once it actually gets time to you know, you have a product that you want to send forward for peer review. It's already gotten plenty of feedback from colleagues, from readers, or what have you. And you'll have practiced your own message, because I think that's one of the biggest challenges is getting comfortable enough with your own message so that you can, you know, posture yourself for others to be able to listen to it, to read it, to accept it.
Well, I mean, yeah, but also who you publish with is, in terms of co-authorship is pretty important. And fundamentally, the whole journal system is run by humans, and humans know some humans and don't know other humans. And it can be important whether the editor or the associate editor, if they know you at all. Then there's a matter of reviewers who may or may not be qualified to review your work. So, I mean, in an ideal world, I think it would be this, as you said, Tom, that you refine your output and then you get it published. But, I mean, it would be really disingenuous of us to ignore that publishing is a political economy of knowledge in a way. And, junior scholars are at a disadvantage when entering that field.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah, well, I'd like to echo on Tom's remark, because, I mean, I feel it in this way as well. I think I and we all were, maybe still are, naive junior scholars trying to get things published, trying to get things through a peer review process. And there are so many kind of struggles around this process that kind of make you hesitant to go for it. In a way that was also when I started to become involved in the podcast, it was also like, what do they expect of me, right? What do the others who are going to hear me, who are going to read my stuff, are expecting of me? And I think what kind of helped me was also to just, get over this whole idea of politics and just try to find my voice in a podcast like this, in trying to write some stuff. And then that's, of course, the naive aspect of it. Like, if you send in your first, you can't say article, but manuscript, you will get it back. And maybe even in a direct desk reject. But even then, if it's a good editor, it gets you some comments that will help you strengthen your voice again. And also probably helps you in steering towards other outlets that are relevant for your paper. So I feel there is also a lot of help in this whole political idea of publishing.
If I can just add, there are obviously kind of struggles within the entire ball game of publishing, but I think one of the great things of this podcast is that it's a project that has shown me how impact and how the communication of studies can also occur in other ways, with other rules, with other kind of maybe also struggles. However, there is more to being a scholar than exclusively the publishing game. And as much as I don't want to dig into this too much, because I know that there's a lot of things going on. However, looking for other kind of side projects or other ways of having impact and communicating your ideas, I think it's very beneficial. Even just for one's personal growth. Yeah, that's it.
Okay, I think we're ready to move on to the next question. Go ahead, Jared.
So question two is, we would like to hear more about a range of different things, socio-materiality, strategy as practice, charisma and leadership in small and medium-sized firms. What are the gaps that we need to plug?
Yeah, I call this sort of like the fill-in-the-blank question. We want to hear more about this. We want to hear more about that. Yeah, obviously, we would love to be able to cover everything, but obviously we can only do so much. But no question, there's a lot of material out there that we haven't covered, and that we're trying to get to. But I guess it does kind of speak a little bit to about what we choose to focus on at any particular given time.
Yeah, and I mean, also not to forget that we started this as the starting proposition of the podcast was specifically focused on classics, right? And by classics, we meant like way classics. So late 1800s, early 1900s texts, plus Maslow. Sociomateriality, strategy as practice, you know, that kind of stuff is quite a lot newer. So I don't know, like, yeah, as Tom said, we'd like to cover more stuff, but there's this aspect of the focus of the show that some of these things fall outside of. And then there's just the simple fact that we are a group of people who share some interests and areas of specialization, and we don't share or don't delve into others. And we have blind spots, and there are some things we find interesting. There are some things we don't find interesting personally. And, you know, this is a podcast, and we first and foremost want to keep it interesting to us, not to... you know, go on a Bhutan death march through all the theories in management and organization studies.
So yeah, if we want to keep it interesting to us, what's the blank spot that we would like to fill then?
I don't know. Some, like right now, for example, and by now I mean the past year, we've been exploring the sort of neglected classics. So when we were coming up with the roster of new episodes, I specifically had a closer look at the works that emerged around the time that Taylor wrote The Principles of Scientific Management and Fayol's stuff. So the very birth of management as a discipline that is codified, but from other perspectives. And that's how we found Spalding. And that's how we found Leon Prieto and Simone Phipps. And well, obviously that's not our achievement, but now the African-American aspect of management is very much coming into the spotlight. So for me, that would be things like that. I would like to revisit scientific management from other perspectives, like Brandeis and other scholars who worked on that, but no one else in the podcast is really interested in going back there for the time being. And then we didn't really cover Follett as much. And we didn't even read the whole book of Fayol. We were at the chapter back then. So for me, it would be really going back to the roots again. But that's just me.
Yeah, I take your point, Dimitri, that these emerging kind of topics don't have the classic text for us to go back to and discuss. So hopefully the podcast continues long enough that eventually there will be classic texts in the fields of sociomateriality or strategy as practice, which doesn't require us to go back to, you know, the philosophy of Heidegger, or which would probably be thought of as kind of classic texts, but are not squarely positioned within management and organizational studies.
It's not a requirement, Jared. It's a privilege.
Yeah. Now that all said, I wouldn't want to utterly dismiss all of these other newer ideas either, because you know, in part, it also depends on the connection, you know, the connections that are there with the classics, or if somebody, if there is a text out there that really brings those to life in a way that's consistent with the way that we look at the classics, we'll certainly consider it, because we have delved into much newer pieces. But it was largely because there was either an ongoing context, like, for example, we did some newer stuff in relation to the as a result of what was happening with the pandemic. And we've also we also took a look at a couple of other that one piece that we did with the human capital hoax. That was episode 36 or 46, I forget. So there are some newer ideas that we do consider. We don't want to say that we won't cover some of these necessarily, but there's something that we want to focus on the classics, and if there's a connection to be made, something that's really relevant that we would want to make use for, yeah, we'll definitely put it on the agenda.
Yeah, and Jared alluded to that, but the podcast is evolving and it's growing, and we are absolutely running out of classics. So, you know, there's room for everything, I feel like. It just we want to make sure that we don't compromise the founding mission and start going after new and shiny things, and at the expense of kind of more foundational but perhaps more neglected ideas.
To just add on to that, I think it's what I've always most appreciated about this podcast is the going back to the origins. My field of studies, my research falls a bit kind of externally, but we do borrow a lot from organization studies. So I'm always curious to know about new authors or neglected authors. But I really like the, how can I say, the journeys back in time, going to those classic texts that were maybe suggested readings during university modules, and maybe I didn't go really to them. I just went to the kind of like the summary, because yeah, we've all done that as students. So I think it's a bit of a balancing act. But what I really like about a classic text is that to a certain extent, it's kind of timeless, as in it can be a lens to read modern and current phenomena. And I don't know, this is kind of what I really cherish about this podcast.
Next question.
All right. Question three. Back in 1993, Jeffrey Pfeffer wrote a highly cited article in the Academy of Management Review called Barriers in the Advancement of Organizational Science, Paradigm Development as a Dependent Variable. So in that paper, he argues that the field of organizational science displays a high degree of dissensus compared with other social science disciplines, such as economics and political science. So the question for organizational science is whether the field can strike an appropriate balance between theoretical tyranny and an anything-goes attitude, which seems to be more characteristic of the present state, as he writes in the article. So the question, to draw upon technology product terms, is this a bug of our discipline or a feature?
It's a good question.
As a internal optimist, or maybe a failing eternal optimist, I tend to prefer to look at it as a feature. To a certain extent, this is a naturally messy field, so the scholarship ought to be messy as well. I mean, we should have a variety, wide variety of perspectives and ideas and theories that, to me, that makes it rich, as opposed to, say, a hard science where you're dealing with something, you know, you're dealing much more with a more physical sense of what's correct and what's incorrect, or what's demonstrable or what's not demonstrable. Here, we're dealing with, phenomenon that's very context dependent, that's has a history over time. It should not be surprising to anyone that such a dissensus exists. And yes, this was written in 1993. I presume that the author of the question feels that this is still relevant in 2020. I certainly perceive that to be. But I definitely see this as kind of a good thing. It does make it difficult from a practical sense, of course, but in terms of applying this. But as long as the human condition is extremely diverse, well, you know, I think this is just natural. What do y'all think?
I would definitely vote for this being a feature. I too agree that it's a positive thing. And I think the reason why I say it's a positive thing, it definitely builds on my experience with my close group of friends. We kind of belong to different sort of fields. So someone is more engineer, doctor, law. And these three fields are very much dominated by a mindset where there's a right and wrong. So when we get into some sort of debate or discussion on any sort of topic, you can see that the people from these fields go in and march in with that sort of approach, while the people from kind of more, let's say, fuzzy areas of social science, they are willing to participate to the debate with more open-mindedness. And we get to something, we kind of construct something. And I really appreciate this as a way of thinking and being able to participate in discussions.
I'm hesitant to comment too much on other fields, as I don't know them well enough and don't feel I can critique them. But my sense from the outside is that some other fields don't have the same ontological and kind of epistemological diversity, which shapes perhaps their collective theorizing. I agree with Miranda that this is a feature of our field of study, but also it's not surprising, in kind of response to the question, it's not surprising that we have this diversity, I would say. I take your point, Miranda. I think our interactions with people from other fields are interesting, and perhaps it's informed by our own backgrounds that we perhaps have an incredulity towards meta-narratives or overarching ways of viewing the world. That seems to me a bit simplistic. So I'm happy to view this as a feature of our field.
I would also say it's a future. It provides an open discussion as long as it does that. Otherwise, it can become a bug, I would say. So if this multiplicity of theories and ideas that are relevant to management and organization studies don't come together at outlets, at platforms like the podcast, this, like the all the journals that we have around, if they become streams of themselves, well, then there isn't an open conversation anymore. And then it is becoming a bug, you might say. But if it is an open discussion, if we keep meeting these different scholars with different viewpoints and different theories, bringing each other together, well, then it is certainly a future, I would say. And then it's a very rich field and it's very open-minded, you might say. There is always something that fits your fits your bill, right? So, yeah, I'm happy to work in organization studies.
Yeah, I don't think it's either necessarily. I've sort of come to think of our field as less an examination of a phenomena and more of a unit of analysis. And so if you think of it that way, then it makes no sense for us to have a handful of grand theories that or schools of thought that direct work in different areas. Because we don't, I think, at least, I'll try to make a case, we don't study some primary phenomenon. We study things in the context of organizations and in the context of management. And this is fundamentally, I think, effectively studying things that political scientists and economists and sociologists and anthropologists and all those people study, but in a different setting, at a different unit of analysis, which to me explains a lot why it can seem like such a mess if you try to think of us in the same terms as you do of economists, for example, or sociologists. So that's my take on that.
Yeah, and I definitely see that point. I do think that sometimes some of us or some scholars, though, do try very hard to, to what was referred to in the question as theoretical tyranny of trying to latch onto a particular label or of very specific phenomenon and to basically promote that as having some dominance in the discourse. And usually what I've found is that when that happens, and for example, when we get folks coming into an organization as a consultant, it's the type of person who brings in their presupposed solution to impose it on the organization, which almost invariably doesn't work, which then maybe it discredits the theory, but it certainly gives it a good black eye.
First, I thought you were going to take a stab at the institutionalists, but then you went after consultants. And to me, that is not theory. That's modelists coming in and doing their models.
Ah, but they have to get their models from somewhere, don't they?
I mean, yeah, like Harvard Business Review and McKinsey Journal of Management, whatever it's called now.
Yeah, but I think that's a very good point, though. But I mean, some level, there's a purpose behind what we're building all of this knowledge for, though. And I think consultancy is one of those things that it's a visible manifestation of the application of knowledge gained. And certainly if you see this sort of same, the modelism put into consultancy, it makes it a little bit less effective in my view. So we carry that back to, within the field of scholarship, that same phenomenon can definitely get in the way. So yeah, I wholly with you. I like the level of analysis metaphor as a way of saying what right looks like.
Because, I think it's true what you said about the consultants and that they are a most direct conduit for our field and, for better or for worse. But, fundamentally, trying to understand management and organization studies by means of models is the same as painting the same house in a different color and saying it's a different house over and over again. It's just preposterous.
That sounds like a deep philosophical question, Dimitris.
Yes, let's talk about that. Pedro's not here, so there's no one to protect you.
Yeah, I was going to say, after we were all saying that, citing on feature, where's Pedro to come in and say it's a bug?
Luckily not here. So we unanimously agree that it's a feature. Next question.
I'm not ready to move on. I just want to pick up on something that Michael said, that ideally there will be a contest of ideas across these different theories in management and organizational studies. But to bring us back to the first question of the politics of publishing, that's a very difficult thing to do, particularly at the level of journal publications, because you need to find an audience or a conversation to plug into. And sometimes those conversations are not the most welcoming of diverse or different ways of viewing particular phenomena. Or even something that comes up a lot, I think, is a lot of those conversations are not willing to revisit the classics as we do in the podcast. I often have thoughts about bringing in this or that theory and get told, oh, that's really old hat, it's a bit risky, it's a bit boring, we need to stick with the new. And so I think a lot of issues in our field always have some connection back to the publishing game.
That's a very fair point. And one of the things that I've did a reflections episode on the same topic, where that same conversation we in my program, we had a discussion about that scholarly conversation metaphor and its limits. I mean, yes, that may very well be true of what it's about now. However, one of the things that I find refreshing, especially here where we're discussing a wide range of things, is we find out how many different fields are talking in a lot of ways about similar phenomena, and to try to find bridges between these scholarly conversations as opposed to just letting them off and becoming insular among themselves. And I think the more that pressure is applied, whatever that means, the more that the bridging across conversations happens, the better off the field is going to be to leverage the diversity, which we are in agreement is a feature.
All right. Our next question to discuss today is, I think the podcast could provide some further understanding for the issues we are facing right now and how organizational theory can help tackle them. These are issues such as virtual and remote work, the end of the office, conspiracy theories, heavy disruption, mental exhaustion and burnout, high uncertainty. It's exhausting even just reading the question. I believe existing theories have a lot to say about those contemporary issues. I think you could also consider covering new papers or books rather than very established ones or streams of literature, and pieces that get awards if they explore new perspectives or literatures, not the things we have seen a large number of times. So probably Dimitri would like to respond to that first bit.
The last bit, actually, I'll start with that. If the things that we discuss here were seen large number of times, we wouldn't have this podcast, right? So that's why we started it, because even though everyone knew of, Taylor, no one that we knew ever read his work, us included. So, seeing and reading are two different things. Other than that, I mean, I think it would be just a very different podcast if we did that. And we have colleagues in Sydney, Kai Reimer and Sandra, with their podcast that I don't remember what it's called now, but they basically just take the news of the week and then they talk about them through the lens of information systems management, broadly speaking. And great, that works for them. For us, if we tried to connect contemporary issues, which are all of these obviously very important, and we did do some work on connected with the pandemic on virtual and remote work, But if we try to match those to some foundational theories of management and try to derive implications, that's a lot of work for us. You know, that's curated scholarship, not a podcast. And personally, I don't feel qualified to undertake something like that. And I think, absolutely don't have the resources and the time to do that. So what we offer is the next best thing. We bring up the texts that may be relevant, and we highlight them, and we bring in our different perspectives and discuss them on the podcast. And then you can take that inspiration or information or both, and you can apply that to contemporary issues. And if you feel so inclined to share the products of your intellectual labor, we will always be very happy to, you know, publish a blog post or something from you on the topic.
Yeah. Now, we do address contemporary issues just sort of part of the organic conversation. It's never planned in advance. It just simply, if we have a reading and it's something that's ongoing in the news, or something that's happened in the recent past, or something that may be coming in the near future, we have routinely gone and had a discussion. But a lot of that is more just to help contextualize the readings in the present day, and also perhaps to raise questions more than try to delve into answers. If we were to try to pre-plan that, I mean, I think the expectation would be that we would have answers. And not for those sorts of things.
Yeah, that's spot on, Tom. I kind of neglected to say that. I think one of the strengths of our show is that we're not historians talking about history and the ideas that are, you know, presented in isolation of something that happened over 100 years ago, and then we go and rehash that and go in, that's not what we do. We talk about them, and then we discuss how those things connect with other things, and of course how they impact practice or contemporary scholarship. So absolutely.
Yeah, and yet we did do some episodes on contemporary issues, especially in the context of this pandemic, right? So we did an episode on remote work, and we did an episode on crisis disaster management. And I really kind of felt very much engaged with these episodes. So in a way, it is an interesting idea to think about this. We also discuss contemporary issues very much organically when we discuss classical text, and I think it's always the second part of the episode. And to me, that's the interesting element of the discussion. I would say, like, okay, we have all these ideas that are developed 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 100 years ago. What can we learn from these ideas in modern day organization and management questions? So I think it's a fair question, and we don't necessarily have to select contemporary specific issues beforehand, but it is something that it's a key future, I would say, to the podcast already, and maybe something to take up for the coming 5 years to keep yourself really connected to these issues.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I guess the question is if that's, you know, the listeners know what we did, but whether that's something that we want to do in the future. And that would be more of a question to Tom and to Jared and to Michael and to the newer members who will follow them. Because myself and Miranda, we've done this for 5 years already, and you know, it's also time for things to refresh to an extent and evolve in new ways.
Just to echo a couple of things that have kind of already been hinted at, I think what makes a classic is the sense that it was contextualized and it was relative to certain organizational phenomena. But what we endeavor to do is to also bring it to life by relating it to the contemporary scene. However, what I really, really like to highlight is that before relating it, we actually do go back to the classic text. And it's a bit like when you read translations, everyone says it's better to go to the original because there's always something twist that kind of gets lost in translation, just to quote. And going back, we've discovered that maybe the message that we kind of relate to Taylor actually was richer. There were other aspects that were included in the original text. So I think that's kind of like the foundational aim that we do. and then we kind of shed light on more contemporary issues.
So we have a follow-up question, which says that I've been thinking back to Schwartzman's 1986 paper and the great insights shared about organizational purpose and the nature of meetings. And there's an extract in particular, which says that spontaneous, semi-private, parallel side conversations or mini meetings are part of what makes meetings so crucial to effective organizing. And so the question is, how do we preserve these types of interactions with the shift to Zooms and Teams and online meetings as the medium of choice for organizing?
My initial reaction to that is, that sounds like a very, very natural inclination that when you're switching something from one context to another, that in the second context, you want it to resemble the first context as much as absolutely possible, because that's what you're used to. And I think that the move to what the author of the question referred to as Zoomageddon, now that's not intended as an indictment on Zoom, I assume, but I mean, it is a new and sometimes uncomfortable setting that we're talking about. And I think, time will tell, but over time, I'm going to presume that there are going to be ways or methods in which such mini meetings, the purpose for which it serves, could very well be exercised in some other way. I think that what we're dealing with is it's only been 6 months since the whole world migrated now to this remote work, and it's going to be a while before we see what really in the long term cooks in. Maybe we didn't actually need these mini meetings. I don't know.
Yeah, I was thinking along similar lines, that before necessarily talking about the value of these things, or the perceived value or the sentimental value, I would step back and think about, well, are these things features or parts of the work, or are they parts of the physical space within which work is done? And if so, is this something that needs to be there, or is this something that can be done in a different way? Are there things that can accomplish the same goal? Kind of just really unpack the value of this. Because from personal experience, yeah, of course, these mini conversations that Schwartzman is describing are absolutely great. You get to connect with your colleagues, you can exchange some quick information, and it's not formalized in such a way that, you know, you need to set up meetings and make calendar bookings or send emails, especially that emails can be misunderstood easily in a variety of ways. But is this an unavoidable element of working in a collective setting, or is this just something that we do because we've always done it, because we haven't had the opportunity to do it in the way that we do now previously? And those would be the questions that I would ask coming into this.
Let me also say that same question also kind of applies in a graduate education setting. Those mini sidebar conversations spontaneous activities were very valuable when we meet in person as a seminar. But as anybody who's been in a distance program, which is now becoming more prevalent, knows, that's a lot harder, and the dynamics of education have changed. So that's definitely relevant in where I'm working.
Well, let's talk about philosophy for a sec, shall we?
We shall.
So
it's taken you a while to bring it up. I'm a bit surprised.
I'm tired. It's very late. I do apologize. Also, there is no Pedro here for me to antagonize, so it's less fun. But I think the question in that respect to raise is, well, how do we perceive our role in the world? Do we work through our intellect and our brain and then our body, or now the digital surrogate of that, which is Zoom or whatever, is merely a medium through which we accomplish that? Or are we existing as embodied beings with other embodied beings, and then the Zoom or the Teams or whatever is a barrier as opposed to a mediator or even an enabler? Because on the one hand, there's lots of benefits to doing this through these softwares that we're using them. We don't need to travel to the same place. It can reach way more people. I mean, that's literally what our podcast is. There's so many thousands of people listening to us every time we release an episode. And thank you, by the way, for that. But how else would this be possible if we didn't have a digital medium to disseminate our voices through? You know, luckily no one sees what we look like as well, so that's probably a bonus. But on the other hand, I can certainly personally attest to the fact that being in a room with other people and being enthusiastic and energetic and engaging others and reading the body language and, you know, the vibe and whatnot does make a difference when teaching a class, for example, or conducting a meeting. You don't have things like internet falling out and you just get disconnected, or sound being wonky and something not working, and you can communicate things by means of your body as opposed to just the microphone and then the digitized rendition of that on the other side. So I feel like that should be something to at least consider when talking about these things. How do we exist in the world and interact with one another?
If only we did an episode on socio-materiality, we might be able to explore the mediatedness of these interactions more
we did
more rigorous.
We did Lucy Suchman's human machine interactions. It's a fun episode. We talked about this exact stuff there, I think.
Just testing your memory, Dimitris.
I remember every episode I've been on, I think.
Well, because we don't have our usual devil's advocate here, I'll play the role a little bit. One thing I do hear about the new world of online meetings is that it's more efficient. There's less time wastage. People feel like their meetings are productive. This is one of the comments I get. And so maybe all we're losing from these so-called mini meetings is just meaningless gossip. You know, how are the rumors going to spread if we can't have these little sidebar conversations? I can see how there are upsides to the new world, the new online world, but I'm just raising that as a devil's advocate.
There is some truth to that. However, there's also some other issues, like, the meeting itself may be more efficient, but to Mitra's point, the work going into the meeting, there's a lot more busy work and a lot more risk of things going awry before the meeting takes place, and afterwards. You know, to me, there's nothing worse than coming out of a meeting, whether in person or remote, where you all agreed, you thought you had the same thing, and then you leave the meeting, and it's like the four people or five people had completely different ideas about, most importantly, who is responsible to do what afterwards. And then you end up having to have meetings to try to recapture what was the actual outcome of the meeting and that sort of thing. So efficient to a degree.
I think kind of recapping, there's definitely a conversation to be had around these meetings. What value do they have? These communications, the face-to-face communications, what do they give you more? At the same time, there is a question, how do we compensate this? So the fact that we're not in the same room, the fact that you can't see me smiling or frowning, how do I communicate that better? The issue around the spontaneity of the meetings, I think something will develop, and I think it's too soon to say what. But I think maybe what will happen is something along the lines of developing some sort of channel that allows you the same casualness and freedom. So it could be actually writing emails that are a bit less formal and understanding what email needs to be structured in a certain way and what email can be a bit more similar to a text message, a check-in, a quick thing. This is what's in my crystal ball, at least.
So is it me, or did you start by pitching The Matrix and then ended up promoting Ralph's book on email writing?
All of it.
I mean, this could just be a step in between coming from physical environment and moving into a fully virtual environment where we sit in our, closets with an Oculus headset on and just do the work in a virtual environment, which doesn't sound like fun, but never know.
I mean, what I What I'd be interested in is seeing differences, and I'm talking about 5-10 years, of people like me that kind of like grew up in an increasingly digital world compared to people who are older and had to kind of learn this from scratch and saw it develop from scratch, compared to like a third group of people that got through in a world that was completely digital, where these sort of interactions are the mainstream, are the basic. And I'd be interested to see what happens.
There's probably a joke here about the TikTok generation doing this pre-meeting casual interaction, but I can't think of it.
Yeah, so our final question today is, how can the podcast explore grand challenges or wicked problems? There is not always a single seminal work that encompasses such problems, which are pervasive in our modern environment.
Is that something people expect us to do?
Are you, Dimitri, saying that it's an unfair expectation for this podcast to solve wicked problems and grand challenges?
I mean, if anyone can do it, then it's us, clearly. But I'm just a bit bamboozled that because I haven't read all of these questions beforehand. And then things about grand challenges and solving the organization studies come up. And I thought we were just doing a reading club that everyone can listen to, basically.
Well, I would hope that collectively the works covered in the podcast could help in understanding and addressing multifaceted complex problems. I mean, the nature of those problems is that their complexity means there's no single solution. So it's unlikely that, well, it's impossible that there would ever be one idea, let alone one classic text that could help us to navigate those problems. But, you know, from across the spectrum of this work, there's probably insights that can help with grand challenges.
I'm wondering if there isn't a classic that we should explore at some point on the matter of complexity, because if you want to talk about a topic that the dust is far from settled, complexity is one of them. There's a lot of contemporary good ideas out there. I mean, a lot of contemporary theories, a lot of work being done on things like business ecosystems and other things that are trying to make sense and make something practical out of the idea of complexity. But how valuable is it? I don't have an answer to that. But certainly, in order to make sense of it, it would seem like we would want to go back and take a look at how complexity was initially considered, looked at. So maybe there's a text out there that we should add, put in the queue somewhere.
A great idea to add to the reading list. Although I think the reading list is already full for a next season. But still, I think indeed that that's a very, very good suggestion by you, Tom, to kind of look back to the origins of complexity theory and kind of find a work that's helpful in addressing or in understanding where this stream of the literature kind of took root and go into do one of those kind of texts. I mean, the question is very it's interesting. There are, in a way, it addresses high expectations of the podcast, and maybe listeners have high hopes of the podcast as well. And so, yeah, I think it's interesting to explore grand challenges and wicked problems related to the idea of contemporary issues, which is made a bit less complex, of course. But it's related to kind of what's the impact of management and organization studies, right? So how is this whole idea that all these ideas that are written down in books and articles anyway relevant for understanding modern dynamics and grand challenges and societal issues? So that's a very fair question, I would say, and very interesting to delve into.
Okay. On a last note, I mean, wicked problems and grand challenges are called wicked and grand for a reason. But I do believe that there is value in kind of piecing things together and piecing maybe contributions from different scholars and different works. And that's kind of like the critical thinking. And I think that is also an aim and a value of this podcast, getting the debate going and looking at things over different episodes and trying to string things together. So maybe not in one episode we'll solve a grand challenge, but who knows, maybe we can string a couple of episodes together and see where that takes us.
Yeah, that reminded me that I remember reading somewhere something along the lines of that wicked problems are only wicked within the boundaries that they exist in. And so the way you solve a wicked problem is by introducing new combinations and new ways of thinking about it. Maybe I dreamt it. I don't know. That does sound like it's making a lot of sense to me, though. And it's, we will not, nor do we intend to be honest, solve any grand challenges or any wicked problems or any problems of any kind, for that matter, on this podcast. Just exposing and highlighting more perspectives, both in terms of the readings that we select, but also in terms of the things that we bring into the show as individual people and scholars. I mean, that's got to be helpful, right? At least to someone. So that's all the questions, right?
That's all of it. I was going to say that would actually be a good send off, unless you want to go ahead and have a deliberate one of some kind.
I do. I have a question to quote Tom Yol. What questions did you expect we were going to get, or what do you think is missing?
From the questions that were, I would say that we kind of would have questions about the back channel, right? So what's happening behind the scenes, or that types of questions on the production of the podcast.
Yeah, I thought so too. I guess no one cares about that.
I too expected like how questions. How do you choose a text? I don't know.
It's a feature of the podcast that we ask the questions that the audience was too scared to ask as well.
Well, the good news is that we do, in fact, have a behind-the-curtain release that's going to be released simultaneously with that. So for those listeners who were expecting us to address those kind of questions here, that release actually covers it. It covers things like, how do we choose the text to run in an episode? How do we structure the podcast, which is to say we don't? How do we do the post-production and all of that? So it's all there in the other release, behind the curtain. And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Finally, we would like to thank some wonderful people for supporting the show. Sarah Otner, Leon Prieto, Hadi Shaheen, Marshall Reiner, Alice Barbosa, Thomas Roulet, Heiko Schmidt, Barton Friedland, Guldem Kara Mustafa, Roberto Bernardi, Marina Timmer, Bernard Hogan, Eddie Hunsinger, Fiona Knight, Peaks Craft, Timothy Paul, Willy Leidon-Wirte, Gabriel Van Bunnen, and Clara Lux. It's easy to support the show, and all you have to do is go to our website, where a donations button will greet you. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.